Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm Doug Goldstein. Today, I am in the driver's seat. And before... Hey, what's that? There's a buzzing going on there. Hey, Joe, what's with that buzz?
I don't know, but it's all around me. It's like there's all these people talking on social media, and I'm wondering if maybe I can make some money off that online chatter, Doug. And it turns out I can, because the Buzz Index uses the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the most sophisticated hedge funds. And those techniques are at your fingertips, and you can make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index is licensed to an exchange-traded fund, trades under ticker symbol BUZ. You'll find out more at moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. We'll talk about it more, Doug, later in the show, but let's get to the letters, man.
Yeah, today is a great day because we've got a number of really, really good letters from our fantastic listeners. And not only that, we have a guest with us today, Mr. Devin Carroll, all the way from Texas. How you doing there, Devin?
Hey, thanks, guys, for having me. Love being on the show.
Yeah, is there anyone else on the line, you know, from Texas?
Well, what's funny is not only from Texas, but from like 3 miles away. We're the only investing podcast that is, besides the Big Picture Retirement, that is like half Texarkana. How great is that?
Wow.
Most people have no idea where Texarkana is, and this podcast is all about Texarkana. I bet Miranda feels bad she's not in Texarkana.
No, Joe. No, I do not. I feel pretty good about where I'm at right now.
About being in Idaho.
Yeah, here I am in Idaho. But you know, I will be seeing you very soon. I will be seeing you in just a few days.
I know. I can't wait. I'm tingly.
So excited.
I'm so excited. Hang out with Miranda.
It's cool. We're all getting together. Actually, we should put together like a big Money Tree Investing hangout, and you know, all the listeners can come and we can hang out. You're all invited, of course, to do that here in Jerusalem. Listen, I want to get started because we've got a great letter from Michael. Michael writes, "Hey guys, I really love the show. I'm a new listener and really find your discussions super insightful." Thank you very much, Michael. He goes on. "I'm 35 and have only really started to consider the future in terms of finances. I contribute to my company's simple IRA, the 3% my company matches, and at this point only have about $12,000 in a target date fund." Oh man, I already got a lot to say. He goes on, "I want to be more aggressive and contribute more, but should I look at changing out of a target date fund? Furthermore, I don't have any debt or student loans and have about $30,000 in cash in my savings account, plus a separate account of 6 months emergency living expenses."
Oh my gosh, this is the sound of all of us going, ugh.
Right? No, good for you, man. This is awesome. "I'm currently living abroad." Oh, I love that too. "I'm currently living abroad for work and not looking to buy a house or have any big expenses within the next few years. So I'm wondering, how can I put this money to use towards retirement, protect against inflation, and also have a little bit of money for travel, and perhaps put a little in the stock market to better understand how it works? I'd really appreciate any advice you'd be willing to share. I honestly hadn't considered any of this until listening to your show, so thank you for opening my eyes." Wow, this is, love this guy. This is a great letter. And Michael, I'm just going to touch on the living overseas thing, because that's kind of my specialty, and then we'll open up to the panel. One of the things I just want to mention, that a lot of Americans who move overseas either permanently or part-time because they're going to work there or retire there, they don't realize that when you have more than $10,000 in an account outside the United States, you have to file a special form called an FBAR, F-B-A-R, a report of foreign bank accounts. So that could be a foreign brokerage account, a mutual fund overseas, which you probably shouldn't buy either, or just simply like any normal person, you wire some money to your Israeli bank or whatever foreign country you're living in, and you know, you put $20,000 there for living expenses. If you don't file this form, it's just an information form, by the way. It doesn't mean you have to pay tax on it to the IRS, but if you don't file the form, the penalties and fees can start at $10,000, and before you know it, you might owe more than 100% of the value of the money that you had in a foreign bank account. So anyone living in America who, for whatever reason, has an account overseas, or if you've moved out of the U.S. and you're a U.S. citizen with a foreign account, make sure you spend a few minutes to learn about the FBAR form. Not difficult to deal with. It's just a reporting form, but the penalties for not doing it are super, super severe. All right, so let's say hi to our guest, Devin. And Devin, talk to me a little bit about what you think of target date funds.
You know, I'm a big fan of automation in investing in just about every area of finance, but I just have never been able to get used to the idea of a target date fund. You know, it's kind of like a self-driving car almost. They haven't quite got all the kinks worked out of those, as evidenced by some of the recent crashes. You know, I do think that individuals need to understand some of the basics of investing. You don't have to understand all of it. You don't have to get into the deep waters of PE ratios and all of that to be successful in investing at all. But, you know, it's kind of like driving my car, right? I know what my steering wheel is going to do. I know what the brake's going to do, the accelerator is going to do. But heck, I certainly don't understand the geometry of my steering and how all of that stuff works. But I don't need to, thank goodness. All I need to do is understand the basics. And I think investing is the same way. So with that said, I think sometimes a target date fund can breed a little laziness. You put the money in there, you leave it, you walk away. And they are going to do their thing for you. When you boil down target date funds and you look at the differences between, I mean, you could take two of the largest target date funds out there that's a, you know, a target date 2040, and you see how their glide path changes or how those allocations change over the years and what that final allocation is supposed to be. You look at the expense ratio difference. There's, I think, a lot of reasons to not use a target date fund and instead break it up into two or three low-cost index funds and just roll with that and make adjustments to that as the years go on, but with a little investment in learning some of those basics.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, I hear laziness. And Miranda, the fact that I'm turning to you to comment on this, please don't take it as any sort of comment on you or what I think about you. But I know that you often tell people that the easy path is a good way to invest. You don't have to make it super complicated. So do you think target date funds, because they're easy, are good for people who don't want to spend a lot of time on dealing with their money?
So I'm not a huge fan of target date funds. Like Devin, I like automation. I'm a huge fan of automation. I do automation and I'm an indexer. So I do like index funds. But target date funds are kind of a little bit different, and you're kind of hoping that somebody else will take care of all that asset allocation for you. And so I actually do my own asset allocation based on my own risk tolerance and where I'm at and where I'm at in my plan and whatever. And so even though mostly I'm lazy with my portfolio, the reality is I do take some time about, you know, twice a year to look at the asset allocation, see if it's still where I need it to be, and make some changes to my asset allocation with my index ETFs and index funds. So there's kind of that, you know, this false idea that, oh, well, if it's a target date fund, then I just got to sit back and let somebody else do it. Well, you might as well just have a regular old managed fund at that rate. I mean, whatever. So, you know, paying attention a little bit and having that connection with your money is still important, even if you're automated. And most of my things are automated. Most of my bills are automated. Almost everything is automated, but I still balance my statements each month. I still check to make sure things are doing what they should, because there have been times in the past where even though it's all automated, there's been a mistake made, because somewhere in all of this mix, there's a human that's done something.
Damn humans.
And so you do have to have that connection to your money. I did want to talk about, you know, he's got $30,000 just sitting in the bank account. So yes, definitely look for a way to deploy that more effectively. You've heard me talk, he's talked about wanting to travel. You've heard me talk about in the past, if you have the risk tolerance for it and the stomach for it. I personally have a taxable investment account that I use for my travel fund. Put a little money there, get that going. And, you know, just look for ways to kind of put the money to work for you, because, you know, he said he does have a separate emergency savings fund for 6 months worth of expenses. So that $30,000 is just sitting in a savings account, losing to inflation. And so, you know, look for ways to deploy that more effectively, whether it's, you know, putting some in a travel fund that you can use, whether it's beefing up your retirement investments, or whether it's, you know, if this is your thing, you know, putting a down payment on a property, an investment property that you can rent out. So really kind of look for different ways to deploy that $30,000 just sitting in the savings account.
Mm-hmm. Joe, how do you feel about target date funds? Do you think that Michael's on track with that, or you should be pulling money out of them?
Well, I agree with both Devin and Miranda that target date funds are not the place where he should be. And I think that they're not great. But you know what? I don't think that's his problem, Doug. I think the big problem is, and this is so often the case, he's worried about the target date fund. I'm worried about the fact that he's saving 3% of his income. And I think that the bigger issue is that he needs to save more money to get anywhere where he's going to go. He talks about having, $12,000 invested. That's not a factor of the target date fund. I mean, the target date fund maybe took away a tiny bit because he wasn't diversified toward his goal specifically. But I think the big reason he doesn't have more money is because he hasn't saved more. And so any way he can find either raise his income or cut his expenses so that he can save a bigger percentage, I think is the win. You know, the issue with target date funds is I don't want perfect to be the enemy of good. You know what I mean? Target date funds directionally are okay. He's going to get where he wants to go. I haven't seen somebody miss their goal because they were in a target date fund versus diversified the right way, the way I would definitely recommend, which to Devin's point is way different than this. But I have seen a lot of people that didn't reach their goal because they didn't save enough. And that's where I'd begin.
Okay, Joe, I think that's a really great answer. I think that you're looking at a 35-year-old who is being smart and thinking about what he's doing, but you're just saying you got to be saving more. I note that he mentioned that he's putting in 3% because his company matches 3%. So we're up to 6%. But I do agree with you that if someone is looking to travel more and he wanted to have a vacation fund as well, you got to put more money aside, especially if you're going to hope to achieve some sort of wealthy retirement in the future. Let's move on to John. John writes, "Hey guys, just a quick shout out from Down Under to say how much I love listening to your show." Don't worry, I'm not going to read the letter with an Australian accent. "I've been listening to it for about a year now and find the variety of topics combined with the different takes on things each of you bring to the table really keeps me engaged with the program. I have a couple of questions that came to me following the recent correction in U.S. markets. Number one, the inverse VIX, exchange-traded note, XIV, which is issued by Credit Suisse, was a big victim of the correction. Could you please explain how an exchange-traded note differs from an exchange-traded fund? And what happened to this one? And question number two, more broadly, with inverse index ETFs like DXD or SQQQ, which are the leveraged shorting of the Dow and NASDAQ respectively, is it not true that over time, the value must degrade towards zero or near zero as the markets invariably rise over long periods of time, and the ETF price is designed to increase only when the index falls? Surely, like the inverse VIX ETN, constant increases in market indices will push the inverse ETFs towards zero. Why then invest in these inverse ETFs? Or should they only be used as a hedge against market losses in the short term? All the best for this year, and I look forward to hearing some more robust discussions for the rest of the year. John." All right, well, John, these are really, really good questions. Let's just go into the technical issue, and then we're going to talk about the strategy issue of how you should invest. Technically, an ETN and an ETF are different because an ETF is a fund, an exchange-traded fund, where the assets are actually put together into a fund and normally held by a trust, and then it's converted into something that trades on an exchange. So for example, if you bought the S&P 500 fund, ETF, there are actually stocks underlying that fund. An ETN, an exchange-traded note, like the one you mentioned issued by Credit Suisse, is actually backed by Credit Suisse. It's a note. If Credit Suisse defaults on this note, you could actually lose your money, not because the underlying assets inside the ETN go bad. It's because the actual issuer of the ETN might have a problem. And that's the main risk. So Miranda, let me turn to you now just to talk about trading volatility. John wrote that the inverse VIX exchange traded note, IXV, is dealing with this big correction. What do you think of trading VIX?
This is kind of funny because a few years ago, I actually had VIX just from a kind of investing challenge we were doing. And I was just kind of playing around with somebody else's money. And I had VIX, and I actually sold it when it kind of went up a little bit around the time of Brexit, which is great because now VIX is so much lower. But yeah, so trading VIX is kind of, you're basically saying, okay, how much uncertainty do I think is happening? And do I think that the market's going to get more volatile? And should I invest in this? And so it's not something that I would actually do as a long-term strategy with my own money. It's something that's kind of fun. It's something that's kind of interesting to look at. Like right now, VIX is very low because for some reason, nobody thinks there's uncertainty in the markets right now and volatility is low. So it just goes to show you can't predict the markets and what they're going to do and you never know. But I don't know, trading VIX, it's not for the faint of heart and it's not for the beginner. It's something that you really need to think about a lot before you get into it. And it's something that you really need to fully understand. It is not something that I fully understood when I originally started doing it, once again, because it was just something I thought would be fun to try with someone else's money for this investing challenge that I was doing. So it was no skin off my back. I did end up profiting, but it's something that I certainly wouldn't recommend to a beginner. And it's certainly not something that I would recommend that you do with a large portion of your portfolio.
Yeah, I like that answer, Miranda. I also like how you're using both terms, uncertainty and volatility. Tell me something, Devin, do you use those terms interchangeably? In other words, do you think that uncertainty leads to volatility, or is there something else? Because I think as Miranda was alluding to, we all feel a certain level of uncertainty, and maybe we feel more of it today than we did yesterday. I'm not really sure, but the VIX is actually trading pretty low. What is the correlation, Devin, do you think, between uncertainty and volatility?
Well, I'm not sure. I do know that every day we wake up, uncertainty is going to be part of the landscape. I mean, that's part of the day, right? That's part of investing in general. And I don't think the answer for that uncertainty is to get into these types of investments, period. But way back in the day when I thought I was a fancy financial advisor, I used some of those without quite understanding exactly the way that they worked and the way that they reset every day on those inverse. And then they had the double inverse, triple. And it was just crazy when you buy something like that and then you see the way that the returns start to move away from the way it's supposed to work. So, for example, if the S&P goes up 10% and you have an inverse fund, it's supposed to go down 10. No, that's not necessarily the way it works. And so, as a rule, I stay completely away from those inverse funds. And I think that's the bigger thing here. I understand he has a legitimate question. I get that. But I wouldn't worry too much about it. No more than I would worry about how, you know, futures contracts trade and other investment opportunities that I just don't take advantage of. I pay attention to the stuff that I use. Outside of that, you know, maybe I'm closed off to opportunity, but there's just too many opportunities that look like opportunities, but they're just money traps.
Joe, let me turn this over to you because you and I have spoken a number of times in the past about leveraged funds. And, you know, a lot of times people get all excited. They go, yeah, you know, if I believe the market's going to go up 5%, why wouldn't I buy a 3x leveraged fund or the opposite if I think it's going to drop? Why don't I leverage up because it's so easy. I can just buy this like any other ETF. And what would you say to that?
Well, it sounds great. By the way, before I get into that, if he's living in Australia, wasn't it appropriate to begin your answer with "g'day, mate" or something like that? Like some colloquialism? I think you missed your opportunity there, Doug. But seriously, when it comes to leverage funds, this is a reason why the average person shouldn't use them because none of us really understand how they work. They reset to the market every day, which means that they're not going to go to zero. They will continue to just go down and lose money for you over and over and over and over, day after day after day. And you'll run out of money well long before this fund does. So, you know, I'd stay away from leveraged products. They're made for traders. They're made for pros. They're not made for a buy and hold investor, which is who I'm hoping is listening to this podcast.
Yeah, well, one of the people we know who is listening to the podcast is someone who's in Australia. And I want to stress something that's so important, once again, for people who live outside the United States who are not American citizens. And actually, I believe just from the statistics we get from our engineer, a lot of people actually who listen to Money Tree are not Americans, but they're investing in the U.S. market. So I just want to tell you something that's really critical, not because I give tax advice to people. I'm not a tax guy at all. I'm not an accountant. I'm an investment advisor. But one thing I do know is that when non-Americans buy U.S. investments called U.S. CITES assets like stocks or ETFs, if a person who's not an American has over $60,000 in these sort of investments and he dies, his estate will be subject to possibly 40% U.S. estate tax, U.S. death duty. And I know this, if you aren't sitting down and you think this is you and you go, are you kidding? What? How could America take 40% of my money, even if I'm not an American? And the answer is, it's just the law and you should absolutely go speak to your accountant. So there are ways of dealing with this, and cross-border investment advisors like me, this is something we deal with every day when people outside the U.S. want to have U.S. investment portfolios. There's certainly legal ways of setting it up, but so many people have no idea. They've never even heard this law, and they end up getting themselves really nailed, well, or their heirs, because so much of their money ends up going to an estate tax that they had no idea about whatsoever. Oh, hey, look, that fly is back. Hey, Joe, I got it.
You got the buzz?
I got the buzz, man. Tell me about it.
Well, if you've ever wondered, our transitions are so great. If you're wondering if our transitions are so great for a reason. No, if you've ever wondered if they were able to capitalize on all that online chatter, the millions of investors on social media, your wait's over, because the Buzz Index uses the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds, and you can make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index is licensed to an exchange-traded fund and trades under ticker symbol BUZ, and it gives investors like you and I a portfolio of securities that show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. They don't use surveys. They don't guess. Here's what they do. Buzz targets the most mentioned large-cap U.S. stocks across the social media landscape, and the more active the conversation, the greater the reliability of the buzz. Each of the most mentioned stocks is then given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics, and the 75 stocks with the most bullish scores, those get included in the index. Each month, the buzz is tracked to capture the latest big data-driven insights, and every month, those 75 companies with the most bullish scores again are selected, and that positions Buzz to capture the highest return potential. So invest in the wisdom of the crowd. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. A disclaimer, I own the Buzz Index. Doesn't make it right for you. You should do your own homework, but I've been happy with it. By the way, congratulations to Jamie Wise and the team over at Buzz. They recently hit another 52-week high, and they had a piece dug in Yahoo Finance about how well the funds perform. So nice job, guys.
All right. Thanks for keeping us posted on that, Joe. Let's get to the letter from Simone. Simone writes, hi again, guys. Thanks for all you do. I've kept my intermediate investment grade bonds at 10% of my 457 and 401k since 2005 by rebalancing. I feel I can still handle volatility and declines in the stock market, although I'm now 45. Oh my gosh. Wait, I'm older than that. Although I'm now 45 with a lot of money, around $600,000. That's a lot more than I had 10 years ago. Is it now time to add some short-term bonds and increase my percentage in bonds to 25%, given the likely event that interest rates will probably go up and my age? I have an otherwise well-diversified, low-cost portfolio of U.S. and international large, medium, small-cap growth and value stocks. I've also opened a brokerage account and started adding REITs, that's real estate investment trusts, to further increase my diversification. Many thanks. All right, Devin, let's start with you once again. What do you think? Should Simone consider increasing the amount of money that she has in bonds?
Yeah, well, fantastic job saving, by the way. You know, $600,000 at 45. Bonds are one of those things that can be incredibly frustrating, especially a short-term bond fund, because they just don't pay a lot of interest, right? So it can be frustrating to hold those in a portfolio. But, you know, I remember watching my son play baseball. You know, a few times that right fielder would get so stinking bored out there, you know, especially when they're little kids that sit down and start pulling clover or something like that. But man, when that ball was hit out there, you needed to have that right fielder. And it's kind of the same way with some of these bond funds. You know, I don't go overboard in my allocation to bonds, but I do think you need to have some in the portfolio. And I think at 45, you've got more serious money now with a $600,000. I would absolutely start to diversify some of that out.
All right, Miranda, what's your take on this? So Devin is telling us about baseball, and he thinks that you've just got to be all ready in case something happens. You've got to increase your exposure to bonds. But let's say you believe that interest rates are going to go up. how would you get into the bond market and really be honest with yourself that you think you're going to make money if you actually think rates are going to go up and bond prices will drop?
Oh, gosh. So I think Devin makes a really good point. Also, I love baseball. So yay, baseball. I agree with Devin. I mean, your short-term bonds are not paying you really good interest. And I have a really hard time getting excited about this sort of active bond trading, I guess. As far as I'm concerned, when we see these kinds of shifts, and if we really think that bond prices are going to drop and the yields are going to go up and we have this rising interest rate environment, to me, it really just makes more sense to take it from an asset allocation standpoint, where you take a step back, you look at your portfolio, you look at your long-term goals, you look at the, as Joe is so fond of saying, you look at the end, you know, you want to do this with the end game in mind. So is my asset allocation a little bit out of whack? If it is a little bit out of whack, now is the time to go ahead and sell some of those stocks that are have the gains, take those gains, put them in the bonds. And hopefully if you're working off a bond fund, so because I like funds, you know, I just do it from an asset allocation standpoint with my funds and make those shifts, make that rebalancing. But I don't think about it too much in terms of, oh my gosh, am I, you know, this sounds almost like market timing, but with bonds. This is like, you know, and I can't get there. And I think most regular people who are not professional traders can't get there either. It's just look at it from an asset allocation standpoint. If it's going to make sense for you to make that shift with your end goals in mind, then yeah, let's go ahead and get it, move into some bond funds. But trying to get that exact right place, you know, you got to be ready to take advantage of what's out there if it works with your portfolio. But trying to maneuver yourself into the exact right place at the exact right time is more than likely going to be futile and make you sad in the long run.
And we do not want to be sad. All right. So happy Joe. Miranda seems to be praying to the goddess of asset allocation. And, you know, you hear this all the time, but
she is my goddess. I mean, I do. Indexing and asset allocation.
Should asset allocation, should that be your religion? I mean, you know, come on, listen, I'm guessing, and if we had a little private vote here that we wouldn't tell the listeners because, you know, we wouldn't want to give it away, I'm guessing that we would unanimously vote that we think that interest rates are on their way up. So do you think, Joe, that now is the time to be an orthodox asset allocationist?
I do think so. And I have seen all the statistics that you've seen, Doug, that show that proper asset allocation is more responsible for you getting to your goal than having the absolutely correct fund, right? We obsess about fees. We don't obsess enough about asset allocation and about having the right stuff. It's funny, early in my career, I met this guy. He was all excited because he had the number one fund at the time. This was before ETFs, that invested in Japan. And the question I had based on his goals in his portfolio, it was just, why do you have a fund that exclusively invests in Japan? Why don't you have an international fund or even a, you know, a Pacific fund? He had one that didn't meet his goal at all, but he had the number one, which was what he was proud of. And he was very, very confidently and very coolly not reaching his goal, which is why, by the way, I think that, you know, getting to the letter, I think age is irrelevant, back to Miranda's point. And I think it's when you're going to use the money, when Simone's going to use the money. I know Miranda already covered this ground, but that's the important thing. Age is irrelevant. If you're not going to move the money anytime or use the money anytime soon, I think moving more to bonds is a huge mistake.
Would you say that? Sorry, let's just be clear. Let's say that, that, you know, she was 70 years old and she had a great pension and Social Security. So her income was set and she owned her house. And she said, well, I'm thinking of increasing my bond exposure. Would you still say, oh, you know, no, but stocks are better for the long term?
I absolutely would, because it's when she's going to use the money. So if she's not going to use the money and it's going to be part of her legacy to her heirs, I would then see when her heirs were going to use the money. If the heirs want to use the money 5 years from now, if she passes away and her heirs are going to use the money right away, then by all means, put it in bonds. But if the heirs aren't going to use the money right away either, age is irrelevant. It's all about when that dollar needs to be harvested.
All right, let's harvest one more question here from Jerry, who wrote to us on Facebook. He writes, I'm trying to figure out what to do with a small windfall I received. My wife wants to pay off our car and pay down the mortgage. However, I'm wondering if it's time to invest. We don't have any investments other than a small contribution I make from my paycheck into a 401k. I'd like to invest more. What do you think? Pay off the debt or invest? All right, let's vote. Devin, pay off the debt or invest?
there's probably some factors here that we don't know that would help us in making this decision. But I'm a big fan of controlling your cash flow. And by paying off that debt, you might be able to control that cash flow. It just doesn't often make sense to invest a windfall of money if you have debt hanging on. But again, some of that may depend on the rates that you're getting on that debt. You know, if you have a loan at 0.9%, then maybe you want to think about investing it instead. But, you know, based on what I see here and what I know, my tendency would be to pay off that debt and control the cash flow.
All right. You sound like Dave Ramsey, where debt is dumb. Miranda, what do you think? You like a little debt or you want to get the investments going?
So for me, it all comes down to that calculation, right? The calculation is, what kind of debt are we talking about? What's the interest rate on that debt? And can that money be put someplace else? I mean, we've used this a lot as an example of my situation where I have student loan debt. It's at a 1.9% interest rate and it's tax deductible. So having me pay it off early to get that 1.9% return, it's not been something that's been my priority. So I still have the student loan debt and it doesn't bother me and I still sleep at night. So it works for me. That is not the case for everybody. If it's keeping you up at night, if it's causing problems in your marriage and this is like a deal breaker, those kinds of things are more important than, you know, mere returns. So I think you both need to sit down to look at it, talk about your money values and see where you're at, because it's really something that is really deeply personal that you need to figure that out. And in my case, you know, you talk about your car, right? You've got the car and you've got the mortgage. So the car, it depends on your interest rate, right? If your interest rate on your car is pretty low, I am one of those. We've actually talked about this on a different podcast. You might remember it, Joe, from ages ago, where I talked about, yeah, I bought a car with a loan and had a 1.9% interest rate and no, it wasn't tax deductible, but it was a 1.9% interest rate. And so I went ahead and bought the car with a loan. And instead of
the horror,
and instead of sinking all of my money into that depreciating, instead of sinking $25,000 into something that was going to depreciate, I put a reasonable down payment down on it and then took the rest of that money, took the rest of that $15,000 and put it someplace else and had much better returns than the 1.9% interest rate I was paying. So it's really all about where you're at with your interest rate, where you're at with your comfort level. Because the other thing you have to realize too is what happens if you suddenly lose your job, right? And then you're stuck with these bills. So that is another thing to worry about and be concerned about. And if you have a good emergency fund and you think that your emergency fund can bear these payments, you know, that's another thing. And same with the mortgage. I never paid down my mortgage. I had a very low interest rate on my mortgage again and didn't pay it off until I sold the house. So you really do have to sit down and think about what is comfortable for you, what makes the most sense for you, and what is going to help you sleep at night and save your marriage. And it's all very personal. You know, for me personally, I can stomach certain types of debt if it's low interest and I can do other things with my money. I can stomach that. I can sleep at night. I feel okay about it. Not everybody's like that.
Right. Which is why I think there's a middle ground here. I think that you can do both. Here's the problem that I usually see with people that want to pay down debt. They take the money from the windfall, they pay off the debt, and then guess what they do after that? Nothing. They spend more money, right? So people want to pay off the debt so they feel better. Well, paying off the debt gives you free cash flow, but until you invest that money and save it, it doesn't mean much to me. So I think the middle ground is maybe to pay off the debt, but set up on an automatic payment immediately the same amount of money that was going toward that debt every month and have it go into a savings account for you to begin getting that savings started that he so badly wants.
Yeah, Joe, I don't think you can be so cavalier at saying that paying off debt only gives you, you know, the freedom or the free cash flow. Really, it gives you the freedom. It is such a weight not to have on you, not to have anyone else in bed with you. All the money you earn is yours. You can do whatever you want with it. And I think the type of person who's going to, you know, get himself out of debt is the type of person who's going to be investing and maybe setting up automatic savings.
Do you see that much? I don't see that much. I see people pay off debt and then they use that free cash flow to spend. I don't see people turn that corner enough. And I wish I saw it more, but I don't.
Well, all right. I can't even think of anything funny to say. Well, says you.
Which is a first for you. That is a first for you. I got him. I stumped Doug.
Yeah. Listen, I want you to, you're looking at him. I mean, you know, across the ocean. But early on, we said, you know, who needs the mortgage? Who needs all this stuff? We never bought a car on payments. We saved, we saved, we saved. We bought the car. And with the house, it's true. We bought the, we took out a mortgage because we didn't really understand. But then immediately we started pounding into it. And within a few years, we're able to pay it off. And just the feeling that I see other people have when they're so burdened with all of their debt. And listen, we can talk, obviously what Miranda said is 100% correct. If you can make more money on your investments than you're paying on the interest, you're a genius. But we all know that's not a guarantee. And if you are talking about saving your marriage and having less pressure, well, not having debt is a great way to have a little less pressure. But hey, I think we're pressured for time. So let's wrap this up. And by wrapping it up, it doesn't give Joe a chance to respond to what I said. And Miranda, since you said the most genius thing today, tell us, what is going on in your world?
Oh, geez. I don't know if you know it, but LendingTree recently acquired Student Loan Hero, the startup company I was working for. And so I got stock options.
Oh,
yeah. So check out plantingmoneyseeds.com for a little more information on what does that mean? What did it mean for me to have stock options in this startup company? And what did it mean once the company sold? There's not a whole lot I can go into detail, you know, those pesky NDAs, but but at the same time, you know, I can talk a little bit about stock options, startups, and what you should do when you suddenly get a decent windfall. It's not quit your job money. It's not quit your podcast money, but it is decent money. And so I talk about that a little bit on Planting Money Seeds.
Oh, that's totally exciting. Congratulations, Miranda. And Devin, what's going on in Texarkana, Texas?
Well, just a little bit of Texas heat today, for sure. A little bit of Texas rain this morning, so that was good. But you know, I'm working on all sorts of exciting projects. So we have the Social Security Intelligence blog that just hit a record, and we are working on a book. This will be the second book that we've come out with. This will be called The Hero's Penalty, and it's going to be specifically for individuals who work at a job, who do not pay Social Security tax, and figuring out how their Social Security stuff works. And so that'll be coming out around September.
And how can people track that?
You know, that's a fantastic question. September is kind of the date we've got set. It will go up for pre-sale around September on Amazon. But we'll be putting out some more announcements on that on the Social Security Intelligence blog.
All right, we'll be looking for that. And Joe Salcihi, what's going on down in the basement?
We are getting ready this fall to go on a 3-city Stacky Benjamin's live tour. We're actually designing shows that are a little different than our usual show, although we have a lot of fun. It's not as much comedy as we're going to do, which is why we're at Comedy Club. So we'll be at the Improv in Orlando on September 25th, and we'll be on October 9th in Kansas City and October 24th in Detroit. I think those are the 3 cities the Beatles went to when they first came to America. By the way, or it's a theory, it could be a bad one. But anyway, for tickets, head to stackybenjamins.com/tour and catch us live when we come to your city.
Yeah, it was a real coincidence, by the way, that today we were speaking to a number of people overseas, and it jives exactly with the recent episode on the Goldstein on Gelt show at goldsteinongelt.com, where I spoke about how to open a U.S. brokerage account from Israel. So it's certainly good for anyone from Israel, but even anyone living outside the United States who wants to have a U.S. investment account, there are a few things you need to know, and that's what we spoke about on the most recent episode of Goldstein on Gelt. All right, listen, thank you all. These were great questions. Please keep sending them in, because I think these are some of our most popular shows. And Miranda, maybe you could wrap it up for us.
Thank you so much for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Head on over to moneytreepodcast.com for all of our archived episodes, for some resources and some information on each of our panelists, and of course, information on our sponsor, the Buzz Index. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and everywhere fine podcasts are sold. And don't forget, no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.